You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her door.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. And you fry some garlic. It's then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
Well, when you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. How are you doing today? I want to thank those of you who came out for the live recording of Mouthful this morning at the Farmer's Market. That show will air in, probably in a couple of weeks. There will be some more interviews added onto it. Anyway, thanks for showing up. Hope you enjoyed the market. And hey, happy 10-10-10. Just love that. And I do have to say happy birthday to Joey, who is curled up right behind me. Joey, the little miniature long-haired dachshund who came into my life in February, turned 10 today. So I think that's very sweet. And Joey loves South A Street. His favorite park that I have ever taken him to is Juilliard Park. You can just feel his energy sort of becomes electrified as soon as we get to that park. And so for the first 10 minutes tonight, we're going to talk about a benefit party coming up on October 16th, I believe. We have here in the studio with us, we have Ty Jones, who may or may not be rested after the fabulously successful handcar regatta. Congratulations. And Thank you. Also have, I forget what her exact title was at the handcar regatta, but I'm sure she will remind us. And a local artist, one of my actual favorite local artists, Mary Jarvis. Welcome to Mouthful.
Hi.
What were you?
Thanks for having me.
What was your job title at the regatta?
Well, I was
refuse roustabout.
Thanks,
she was
Ty.
The queen. She was the queen roustabout. Of the rescue roustabouts.
I rescued the streets from garbage.
From 15,000 people.
15,000 people. That's holy right. Mackerel!
Yeah.
Holy cow!
It was an amazing. Amazing event.
It was amazing.
Beautiful.
It was amazing this year. Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, bless you for that VIP tent. I would have probably lasted
Melted.
About 15 minutes.
Tent.
Yeah, you like hot weather, my dear. I melt in it. I mean, even before I got to the tent, I was starting to disrobe. I was taking off layers of my costume.
Was good.
Yeah, you were good. You can handle the heat. Anyway, congratulations. It's
Thank
really
you.
A great event. And it made you so famous that now you're going to be an auctioneer for the first time.
That's right.
And it's an auction coming up next Saturday night, the 16th, for the Church of One Tree.
Well, it's at the Church of One
at
Tree.
At the Church of One
Tree. And it benefits the City of Santa Rosa's arts program.
Arts program. And the church borders on...
Juilliard Park.
Juilliard Park. And it's right... I guess the actual address is on Sonoma Avenue. Well,
yeah, 942 Sonoma Avenue. Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that Sonoma Avenue does come that far west.
Yeah, it's Sebastopol Road going east of the freeway, and it's Sebastopol Avenue going east of the freeway.
Right. And the other,
yeah.
So tell us about it. I know it starts with a preview at 5.
Preview at 5. Auction starts at 7. I'm your guest auctioneer. And we've had, we have like 49 lots, I think, donated from artists primarily in Santa Rosa, but also around the county. It's a lot of great stuff. I've been previewing it for the last week or so. A lot of good stuff. A lot of good reserve prices starting. The holidays are coming. I know it's a little early, but there's some really, really good work in here.
Mm-hmm. Now, is everything going to be part of a live auction, or is some of it, is there a division with silent and live?
There is no silent auction.
Bummer. I'm good at silent auctions. Because, you know, I know when to place my bid.
That's
and
right.
I just sort of hover.
It's all live auction. It's really fast. It's not going to be grueling. I think we've got it like 2 or 3 minutes per piece, and we're just going to, we've got 40 pieces, so I think we've got it timed down to a little over an hour.
Wow. That's amazing.
So that way we can go out and have fun. I've got some great wine. This will be the first public event at the Church of the One Tree since it's been refurbished by the City of Santa Rosa.
Uh-huh. And it's owned by the City of Santa Rosa.
It is owned by the City of Santa Rosa.
And, you know, we were talking just before the show started that it was used by Ripley.
Yes, for Ripley's Believe It or Not.
And when I first moved here, I think there was a big sign over it. And maybe more than just that. I remember a big archway sign, but I think there was another big sign. It was not exactly cheesy, but moving in that direction.
Old Santa Rosa.
Old Santa Rosa.
Right, right.
I bet somebody, I bet you Gail Barron. In fact, I think in Gay's book, I think in her book, Santa Rosa, a 20th Century Town, I think that there's a shot of that with the sign. I'm almost positive that that's where I've seen it, because I have seen it. Mary, you've got a piece. Tell us about the piece.
Yes, I'm donating one of my favorites. It's a partner. Well, it's a diptych, Blue Wood with Sunset. It's lot number 18. It's 24 by 48 inches. It's an oil painting. And I believe the opening bid on this painting is going to be $300. And I'm just here to tell you that my wood grain paintings are selling now for quite a bit more. And in fact, it should be selling, because of what they have been selling for, this one should sell for $3,272. So I'm hoping that there's a lot of interest in it, and that the bids will be high and help our city, because that's why I'm donating this piece.
I want you to talk a little bit more about wood grain paintings, because I think for people who haven't seen those paintings of yours yet, when you say wood grain, I think, what I would think of before I knew you is those little cans of varnish that I would have to buy to touch something up, and just those little snapshots on the front
grain.
So those paintings are so remarkable. Tell us how they come about.
Well, it started with the paint, because I love the properties of oil paint, and I wanted the subject that would best describe or explain the stretching capabilities of the medium. And
so the ability of
it did everything I wanted
stretched.
It to do.
So to be stretched on the canvas.
Right. So the wood grain, my subject always takes a back seat to the properties of the medium. So my subjects are, well, they vary, but I've been with this subject of wood grain since 05, and I'm going strong with them. I really like them a lot. And they're big now. They've gotten 7 foot and selling.
I see the perfect place for them are buildings, homes, wineries, companies, whatever, that have both high ceilings and really beautiful natural light.
Yes.
I think they just look fantastic in that environment.
Yeah, I paint in a really glassy layers, and they're just really beautiful, if I do say so myself.
They are. They are really beautiful. And these are primarily blue with one red.
Right. The ones that, the ones donated are, primarily blue.
Mm-hmm. And really, very, very striking work. And while I have you here, you have some work from a previous period, your pointillist period, or perhaps your first pointillist period, up at a Hammerfryer gallery in Healdsburg. How long will that work be up there?
I think that ends the 18th, and those are starting to sell now, and those are really going for high prices.
Yes. But they are Mary's pointillist paintings. Are remarkable. If you get a chance to get a Hammerfryer, is there on Healdsburg Avenue, you know, a few blocks before you get into the center of town. They're closed on Monday. I went up last Monday. Oops, forgot to check. Galleries are always closed on Monday.
Thanks for trying.
Anyway, there I was. Well, I've of course seen them several times, but was taking someone else to see them. Anyway, if you get a chance before the 18th to go up and see Mary's work, really check it out. It's quite remarkable. And then coming up on October 16th, is there an admission fee in addition?
There's $35.
$35. Okay.
And there's wine and food. So during that two-hour preview period.
And then they start preview period for 2 hours. That's a really fun part. You're just walking around.
Mixing.
Eating, drinking, and looking at art.
Looking at the Church of the One Tree, which has been closed for a very long time.
I can't wait to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never been inside it.
I haven't either. Yeah, so.
And how does one get tickets?
Oh, my goodness. I know that you can go on the City of Santa Rosa's website. And I believe, are they also, Mary, are they on brown paper tickets?
You know, I think if we just tell people to go to the website, that's good enough.
Yeah.
No problem. If you need to, all you have to do is Google Church of One Tree plus Santa Rosa, and you will get there. And I know that there's been a lot written about this upcoming auction, and I really appreciate you guys taking the time to come onto Mouthful and tell people about it.
Thanks.
So, you know, it's
Thanks, Michelle.
Another unique part of Santa Rosa, and that whole area from Railroad Square and the historic district over there up through the South A Street district is just such a fabulous
place. It's a building.
Place.
It's coming alive. Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, it is. So anyway, good luck. I hope
Thank
to
you.
See you. I hope I see you there.
You'll see us there.
Well, I hope
see
I make it.
Yeah.
My plan is to make it.
Okay.
And we are going to take a little musical interlude here, and we'll be right back with Dan Imhoff returning for a third or possibly a fourth appearance here on Mouthful. It's Mouthful, and I am really pleased to welcome back Dan Imhoff. We're trying to figure out how many times he's been here, and we know it's at least three. Wait, politically correct nutrition. Isn't that you?
No.
It's not. I always think it's you.
No, I don't remember that one.
Then that must be why I can never find the book, because I go looking under your name, and it's like,
nope.
Who did I loan that to? It should have been you. Food Fight, Paper or Plastic, Farming with the Wild are the three books that Dan has spoken about previously on Mouthful. And now he has a very heavy book, literally and figuratively. Have you put this on a bathroom scale?
It's almost 7 pounds.
7 pounds. I was going to say it's over 5.
Because we have to ship it, so.
Okay, that's right. So, you know. So it's CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories. Now, this is a book that I recommend, but it's also a book that I recommend reading from the back forward. I think here in Sonoma County, at least with people, say, who listen to Mouthful and think about such things, we're your choir.
Yeah.
You know, I think you have a really pretty big population in Sonoma County that is aware of the issues that you're addressing and is trying in a variety of ways to have more sustainable, kind, compassionate sources of food.
We have to remember that 65% of Californians voted for Proposition 2 in 2008. And so I do think
it probably remind people what Prop 2 was.
It was the proposition that will put a ban on certain types of animal confinement,
right.
Battery cages for laying hens, and gestation crates for cows and crates for veal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of a moot point in the case of hog production, because there's not a lot of hog production, at least right now in California. I don't see it happening. And veal production is not a big issue in the state as well here, but certainly battery cages.
Battery, yeah, absolutely. We have a lot of chickens in Sonoma County, and excuse me, not a lot of them live the idyllic life that some of them do here.
Yeah. Well, when you're talking about you know, the audience here in Sonoma County and readership, etc. We're having an event on Thursday, on October 14th, at the Sonoma Country Day School, and we're going to be featuring some of our Northern California leaders to have a discussion that's basically centered around, if we don't have this mega industrial food production, in this case, mega industrial animal food production, then what can we have, and how do we have a conversation about scale? How do we expand the scale? What are some of the issues that right now keep the scale from expanding? And so, yeah, I think that definitely Sonoma Countyans and many Northern Californians really care about the ethical treatment and the environmental impacts of animal food production. But somehow expanding the scale of it, knowing what we know, you know, that's really going to be the work for a couple decades.
Yeah. Now, when you set out to research this book, I should say you're editor and then you've written a lot as well. And all you have to do is read through the table of contents to see that this had to have been emotionally challenging or brutal at times to research.
Oh, yeah. I seem to like be a magnet for projects like that lately. Even writing about the Farm Bill was very emotionally challenging in a different way. It was just so brutally boring at times that, you know, you have to climb yourself up to a number of base camps on any project where all of a sudden you feel like you have a real familiarity with the material, and then you start to be able to be creative in your thinking about it. But probably when I started CAFO, I have to say that it was a project that came to me and I did not start. So I...
You mean a project that literally came to you?
Yeah.
Not through inspiration, but
no,
someone contacted you?
No, not at all. It's a large format book. And it's one of many that have been produced by the Foundation for Deep Ecology in Sausalito that deal with mega technologies, mega economies of scale and resource extraction. They've written about clear cutting and industrial crop production, arid lands, ranching. Most recently, they put out a book called Plundering Appalachian about
the
mountaintop removal coal mining.
Yes.
So, and they're large format books. They usually have, you know, dozens and dozens of essays and then extensive photo essays. And the group that started the book really couldn't get it to the finish line. But what I inherited was very difficult, because in the time that they'd stopped working and I picked it up, there were numerous studies that came on the line. One was the Pew Environment Report on Industrial Animal Food Production. The UN put out a book called Livestock's Long Shadow. And then the Union of Concerned Scientists came out with another book on CAFOs. And it really changed the whole scope of what kind of data was out there. It went from the 1990s to, you know, the mid 2000s, and probably just getting up to speed, I read maybe 40 books on the subject. And, you know, I mean, there's been a lot written.
Yeah. For somebody who hasn't thought, for somebody who's not in the choir of sustainability and humane treatment of animals, how do you start to get them to care? You know, somebody, I always think about people who are shopping for the cheapest food because they have a family to feed and they have a limited budget. and they're going and they're buying, you know, boxes of frozen hamburger. What thread can be, you know, pulled to reach people and let them know why it matters to them, that it's not a luxury that, you know, well-off yuppies can, you know, afford?
It's a really good question, and I can't say that I have, you know, that trump card that I would just put out there. You know, what was the most shocking thing that I learned? Probably that they feed cattle poultry manure, like, as a big part of their feed ration, because that just fits the economic mindset of the CAFO perfectly. You just cram as many animals as you can in the smallest space, fatten them as quickly as possible at the least cost. You know, who cares if the animal doesn't really have a life that, you know, that is at all natural or naturalized. You know, the other thing about the average person is that as this industry, as we've gone from an industry of a culture, an agriculture of millions of farmers, to now, you know, we have 300,000 operators that produce 90% of all farm and agricultural output. As we've gone in that radical revolutionary direction in the late 20th century, in the last 50 years, the corporations have gotten bigger, the operations have gotten bigger, their power has gotten immense, and it's very, very difficult to have access to these places. Mm-hmm. In fact, in 3 states, it's illegal to take a photograph of a CAFO without permission of the owner. And in 13 states, it's illegal to disparage a food production operation that has yet to be challenged in the Supreme Court.
I was going to say, wait a minute. It's illegal to disparage
food production. And I mean, you can understand, because there are billions of dollars at stake. And when you're a country that really, you know, increasingly just consumes on credit rather than, you know, producing things that are sold to the world, our agricultural exports, and we do export a fair amount of agriculture, they help balance our payments a bit, you know.
So at least, money is, in a way, money then is the driving, because as soon as you say this, like, you can't disparage food production, but at the same time, anybody can go on television or anywhere else and call our president, you know, a Muslim, say that he wasn't born in this country, and they can call him a fascist.
Sure.
Yeah, so you can do that, but you can't say, hey, they're treating their animals badly at this production facility.
Yeah, and I think we're numb. You know, many of us, the listeners and the audience and readership, et cetera, that you mentioned from Sonoma County, you know, for many people, increasingly just knowing more about their food and having that connection with where it came from and who produced it under what conditions and exactly what you're going to do to make the most of this beautiful thing and your connection with nature and sustenance. And for many people, that's a big part of their day. That's a big part of the joy that they get out of life. But you know, the majority of people don't have that connection right now. And so we really did go with the photos, and we really did go with the shock and awe. And in addition to the 40, you know, plus books that I read in trying to find the absolute best pieces to describe this industry, we collected 6,000 photographs. And from the 6,000, we ended up with 450. And of the 450, they came from perhaps 70 different photo agencies, nonprofit organizations, and professional photographers. Mm-hmm. Most of the photos, by number, came from Associated Press and Reuters and Corbis and agencies that actually had access to these animal factories. Mm-hmm. And had model releases And yeah. And so what I would ask a person who might listen to this show and hasn't made up their mind is to find their way to a library where I think the dog is seconding me on this.
Yes, that's how he claps.
Find a way to just take a look. And if you have a child, take a look with your child. And I think anyone who's really, really carefully looking at these pictures that you could find in the newspaper would be aghast at the state of animal food production, today in America and increasingly all around the world.
I always think, and this is, in a way, it's a little too frivolous, given the gravity of this subject, and it's horrible. But I always think Scoop Nisker back on KSAN saying, I think it was him and one of his personas, or maybe, I think it was him, you are what you eat, so why not eat someone smarter and more beautiful than you? So when I think, my version of that is, if you are what you eat, why would you eat anything that had a really sad and cruel life? Why would you be putting anything in your body that comes from this really sad source? Maybe that's a selfish way to look at it, but it's one of the ways that I think about it. That's sort of a shortcut. You don't need to know necessarily all the details, but it's like, if you're going to eat animals, you know, eat animals who have been showered with love.
Yeah.
And live good lives.
I mean, yes. As Jonathan Foer says in his book, Eating Animals, you know, why don't we just eat our dogs? They get treated really well. They get fed really well. You know, you spend all this time creating these animals, and in many cultures they have. You know, I think if you look back into history, this is not a new problem.
No.
This is, mm-hmm. and you see very wise people for many, you know, thousands of years who have made their own ethical choices about what it means to be human and, you know, how that diet manifests their will out in the world. The one thing that I would add to this idea that we are what we eat is that we're also what we eat. And when you start to look at the food chain,
yes. Yeah, that's
you
a really
can
good
just
point.
Become completely horrified.
Yeah.
You know? And the problem is that really, you know, by packing these animals into these factories and packing them, you know, full of protein and raising them so quickly, we're actually making a food system that is not healthy for us at all. I mean, we're in many cases we can make protein A that is so cheap that we consume too much of it, really, mm-hmm. in terms of our balanced diet, but also, you know, protein that contains solid fats that we can't digest. And that's not really even talking about, you know, the environmental and the economic impacts on communities.
And what happens to an animal when it's forced to grow quickly? That's not natural. One of the things we have in the news a lot right now, slightly off topic but under the same umbrella, is this salmon.
Yeah.
That now grows, what, three times faster than a natural salmon in the wild. And, you know, it's not like, well, it's going to taste the same, it'll be fine. It's like, which is what, all the news, a lot of the news you read, although Congressman Mike Thompson wrote a fabulous editorial that was in the Press Democrat, I think, earlier this week about why this Frankenfish is a really bad idea. So we are seeing talk about it.
Well, I mean, one of the words you said there was taste. Right? what happens when we have these industrial breeds that are, you know, they're either bred to put on weight as fat and be lean in the case of hogs. You know, they've made the hogs so lean.
As Julia Child said, they ruined pork.
Okay, they end up, you know, pumping it full of salt and other flavors to give it flavor. Or you know, the way, or they've grown so fast that the meat actually becomes mushy. You know, the challenge in the dairy industry is that they're just literally burning the animals out so quickly, and then, you know, there's so much milk on the market that, you know, every few years there's just a massive culling of the dairy herd, and they become hamburger.
And that's what the bovine growth hormone.
Or just, you know, it's just actually the Holstein breed itself is really being, it produces an enormous amount of milk compared to any other breed. Mm-hmm. And yet it's putting so much milk out, its bones aren't developing properly. It just has a short, extremely sad life, mm-hmm. Unlike even 30 years ago. And the meat doesn't taste good, and so we've got some really really challenging cycles if we ever want to move beyond this system, because we've become so reliant on so few breeds. And these breeds are completely bred to be industrially fed, and I think everyone recognizes that that's really not the way ahead, and so we have a lot of work to do in a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I say, or the reason I say, this is a book to start from the back.
Yeah,
because the last number of the last bit of the book is very optimistic.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. You know, normally my books are about 1/8 bad and 7/8. You know, these are the devilish details about trying to do something better. And in this case, as was the format demanded this book, it's about 7/8, really, really hard hitting. And then we do get into, okay, so if we don't have CAFOs, then what are we going to have? And there's a really broad spectrum of voices in there, anywhere from, you know, a lot of voices about pasture systems, and even one from a vegan writer, Eric Marcus, who's saying, you know, really, if you carefully look at animal agriculture, we should really be looking at a vegetarian society.
Interesting.
I mean, that's not my particular
that's
view,
not the whole
but
thing,
it's represented.
It's a view that's represented, and I think those views, I think that's an admirable element of the book. I think all those views should be represented. Here you have towards a humane, equitable, and sustainable food system.
The last section there is called putting the CAFO out to pasture. And of course, you know, that's kind of a term for what, you know, a farmer used to do to an older animal, right? When it's no longer
out
productive,
pasture,
it would just be put out to pasture. And in this case, what we're talking about is literally changing the way we raise animals from having these hundreds of millions of acres of feed grains that are used to fatten these animals in confinement. We're saying maybe 10 billion animals is too much for Americans to produce. And we're not even talking about aquaculture. Really what we want is to protect our soils with deep-rooted, permanent, perennial plants, and to find a way to integrate animals back onto the landscape. This is going to be extremely challenging because for the past 50 to 60 years, we've been doing just the opposite. Building, mm-hmm. you know, a whole food production infrastructure that's built on massive amounts of feed grains and far away transport and production, mm-hmm. and confinement.
Let's talk about one of the things that I think troubles most people who begin to think about such things, and that's the process of killing the animals. Mm. I get a lot of emails from people, sometimes new vegetarians, people who have eaten meat all their life. One really, really nice, I mean, I haven't met her, but in emails, 77-year-old woman who has just decided to become a vegetarian because she just can't stand the thought of the process of their lives and their deaths. Yeah. So what is death like in the CAFOs, in these factory?
Well, just to step back a second, I mean, it's kind of at my house, I raise animals, mm-hmm. and I have for some time. And personally, I'm way more of a conscious omnivore and prefer a vegetarian diet. But, I have two children and a wife, and they love meat as well as, you know, all the other things that I grow. And I take particular satisfaction out of growing healthy, beautiful things to eat. And if you're going to eat an animal, it has to die.
Right.
You know, and my daughter, when we first got our first pigs, you know, she made this poster the night before, you know, the slaughter was going to happen, save the pigs. And she, you know, she was really upset, but she's the first one to go down and have the bacon. And mm-hmm. so, you know, this is what has to happen. And I think really what we want to have is that animals do have a quality of life, and mm-hmm. then they have a very swift and
private death, I would say.
Yeah, I wouldn't say private, but, you know, I mean, I think that I don't know if humane is the right word, but it, you know, it has to be swift. And there have been religious edicts governing how animals
yes.
should be killed ethically
yes.
for uh-huh. you know, thousands of years.
Yeah.
And so the challenge with the CAFO industry is that as the industry's gotten bigger and bigger, so have the slaughterhouses gotten bigger mm-hmm. and bigger and fewer and fewer.
Right.
And the rate of killing in the slaughterhouses is chilling. The only experience that I've had has been in a modern poultry plant, but, you know, and this was a relatively small one that was maybe slaughtering 50,000 birds a day. But you have to realize that every 2 seconds, a bird is being put on on the hangers,
mm-hmm.
and that every 2 to 4 to 10 seconds, a worker is making a cut. And the pace is relentless.
50,000 a day. That's
and when you yes. and that's small. You know, they have facilities. They're doing 30,000 hogs a day, and 300,000 birds a day. And one of the pieces in the book in CAFO was written by an anthropology professor from Arkansas, and he writes about he spent a couple summers while he was going through school on a poultry line. And he interviewed numerous workers, and the workers were saying that the monotony of the killing is really what drives them crazy, and they just have to make up games. They have to change hands. They have to promise God that they'll never come back if he lets them make them to the break. But I think there's a lot that's been written about the human cost to the occupational hazards of this
yeah.
work, just the
yeah.
crippling, repetitive injury. But there's also the whole psychological part
has to be done.
Yeah.
The reason I said private was the work of Temple Grandin and what she did to make slaughterhouses, I don't know if more humane is the right way to put it, but one of the things that I think heard her talk about is animals not seeing. I mean,
well, I think really what Temple is saying, as I remember, because I read her book, Animals Make Us Human, and I would recommend that to anybody. It was a book that definitely opened my eyes about, she's just so thoughtful and really, knows a lot about the industry. And then I got to interview her. But what she's saying is that the animals should seek. They should be having seeking behavior and not fear,
mm-hmm.
not fearful behavior. So whatever the system is,
mm-hmm.
they should be going at it like they're looking for something, right? Mm-hmm. They're curiously moving mm-hmm. forward, and they're not fearfully, you know, being beaten or you know, just shoved or yanked or whatever. But I think, you know, what we're in desperate need of here in Northern California as we move forward, and there will be a good discussion about this on Thursday night at Sonoma Country Day, is a few processing facilities that are mm-hmm. much smaller.
Yes.
And I think the government's starting to recognize, and people all over are starting to recognize, that, you know, if the regulations are only for these massive plants, then it leaves the small and the medium scale behind.
Yeah.
But if we are going to eat animals, we certainly have to find, you know, we have to process them safely and hopefully, you know, to the best of our abilities. When did you see the movie, the Temple Grandin movie?
I saw most of it.
Well, she says something in there. She's watching, there's a scene and she's watching Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. And, you know, this lion is ripping apart a jackal or something. And she says, nature is cruel, and we don't have to be cruel. And that's what, you know, when you're talking about this issue, ultimately, if you get into it, I think you have to get down to the deep, deep questions about what are we here for, and, you know, what's right and what's wrong. And you know, people have been struggling with it for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, if cruelty is an option, I think the human choice is to opt out.
And not only
or
that,
the humane,
you know,
choice anyway.
And cruelty is made some kind of economic virtue. You know, we need it because it's cheap. But,
exactly,
you know, we don't really need triple cheese bacon burgers all the time. It's not necessarily a right.
Or even a good idea.
Or a good idea in excess, for sure.
Yeah. And in your exploration of this whole topic, where is the bulk of factory farming? I mean, is the bulk of factory farming consumed in fast food restaurants, or is it just so pervasive it's everywhere and sustainable is a very small part? Cruelty-free is a very small percentage.
Yeah, it's a very small percentage.
The bubble we live in here in, you know, Northern California.
You know, it's hard to exactly pin down what percentage of the animal food products come from CAFOs, but rest assured, it's the majority. Mm-hmm. And what you find is that the industry's become really geographically concentrated. You know, there's lots of poultry and hog production in the South, and Iowa is a huge poultry and hog producer, and obviously, you know, it grows huge amounts of the grain. But the arid West, New Mexico, California, Idaho, arid Washington, places that are basically, you know, really, really low rainfall areas, have been taken over by industrial dairies that just, you know, suck massive amounts of groundwater or water to keep the dairy milk flowing. And so what you find is if you're part of this, you know, CAFO food system, there's a very good chance that you're eating at the expense of somebody else's community and welfare. And that can't be a good feeling.
No, it can't. And it's not. And, you know, what about children and teaching children about this? Have you had any exposure to that?
Well, you know, I have my kids.
You have yours.
Yeah. And they used to, you know, when you're looking at this book, is big. It's 12 inches by 13 inches, and the spreads are, you know, 12 by 26 in many cases. And my daughter used to come and she would just stare at some of the mock-ups and say, wow, that's really, I don't think that disturbing was the word, but she also said it looks somehow cool, you know. And so I've been working with an Italian graphic designer for, 20 years now. And if you want something to look really interesting, you have to get an Italian or a Japanese designer. And I think the pictures speak a lot to the kids. Someone asked me at dinner a couple weeks ago, what they should do. They said, what can I do in my life? We belong to a CSA, a community-supported agricultural arrangement where they're a member in a farm and they get weekly deliveries of the produce.
Which is a great system.
And they said, well, I what do you do with the your other, other things you buy? Well, the nanny buys them. So these people obviously had beans, and I said, okay, well, for the animal products, I think you should ask the CSA farmer. Who does he admire? Who raises poultry and pork and, you know, grass-fed beef and dairy? And then I thought, you know, you should raise chickens in your backyard. And I think it'll be a great experience for you. And you'll understand what it takes. You'll understand what a responsibility is to keep the animals safe and clean. And you'll have the most amazing tasting eggs. And it will take you to a whole new level of appreciation of food. And that's what I really want for the children, to have experiences like they get at Bear Farm here down in downtown Santa Rosa, where, you know, they're right in the inner city and they see such beautiful living growing going on, and they get to eat the food. And kids need to not just be scared. I think that they have to be.
Oh, no, you have
they
to
have engage to be empowered,
them.
Right?
They, absolutely.
And I think hopefully we won't lose these great, student farming programs that we have going on. Yeah. I'd just like to see them expanded so much.
Well, today I was talking with Lucas, he's my grandson, and he's 9 years old, and I was fixing him breakfast from eggs from the chickens next door.
Yeah. Excellent.
And I only have good eggs. We only have good. We know the chickens, and you know that's one of the easiest entries. Have good eggs. It's easy. But he started telling me about, you know, fourth grade is California curriculum. Mm. They do, you know, everything about California, the missions, Native Americans. He told me a very interesting story about how he's talking about how some Native Americans, how they hunt. And what had gotten through to him was really quite remarkable. Talked about some little, some sort of tranquilizing plant or something. And then the animal just walked off and then collapsed. Talked about how the hunter would go over and talk to the animal after it had died and say, you know, I'm sorry, but my family needs to eat, and you have given up your life for my family to eat. And then he just talked about carrying the animal back and how far they would sometimes go, but how gently they treated it. And it had really got, I could see, it really made a point with him. I thought, no, he goes to a public school. It was to the fabulous Oak Grove in Grayton. It's just a great school. But something really got through to him that he's not going to forget. I mean, it's the way has been paved with him for a while because, you know, of who his grandma is.
Yeah.
So he thinks about these things, and he always has. But I thought, this is great. I mean, I remember the curriculum in fourth grade. We didn't go down that route.
Yeah, I don't remember that lesson there. That's a great lesson. You know, I think I have so much hope for the kids.
Yeah.
But we just have a lot of work to do to, you know, justify that hope.
So I always say, start with, either, if you can't get chickens, get real eggs. Get,
right.
You know, support your neighbor.
Oh, we eat a lot of eggs in my house.
Yeah. So in Sonoma County, it is very easy to get eggs from chickens that have good lives.
I think so.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
More and more people.
More and more people are getting chickens. And it's interesting, all over the country, there have been, in a lot of cities, regulations that ban chickens.
Right.
And that legislation is being overturned.
Yeah,
all
there's
kinds
a whole
of places.
Backyard revolution. And,
yeah. So there's that. There's eggs. And then we do have the Sonoma County Meat Buying Club. But more than that, there's a Clark Summit Farm.
Yeah.
And now another farm in the name, I just found out about it. A local farm has started, you know, a meat CSA. And some of the regular CSAs include
eggs,
chicken, or, eggs, yeah. that sort of mm-hmm. thing. So one of the things I'm going to do soon is post on Mouthful's either Facebook page or the page here at the station, is I'm going to post some of those resources just to remind everyone again.
Well, for anybody who comes on Thursday mm-hmm. to the Sonoma Country Day School, it's going to start at 6:30. Doors open at 6:30. The event will start at 7. Cindy Daniel, who
yes,
is
Cindy Daniel,
fantastic, fantastic organizer, local food producer and activist. She's organized this whole event, and there's going to even be a farmer's market after the event
great.
With all these producers,
oh,
and you can learn all kinds of great thing and actually meet the producers, the growers themselves mm-hmm. for meat, dairy, eggs, and milk.
That's in. So it's, the doors open at 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
What time does the discussion begin?
Discussion begins at 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And Steph Larson of the Sonoma County uh-huh. Meat Buyers Experiment, she's going to talk about that whole project. And we have Dusky from mm-hmm. Bovlo and Zazu, mm-hmm. Iron Chef.
Right.
She's going to be represent kind of the cooking side and what you can do in your home and maybe in your restaurant. And then we have Mac Magruder mm-hmm. from up in Potter Valley.
Potter Valley.
And he raises hogs and beef.
Right. There was just another real recent event. We had the author of a book about cooking.
Right,
and
good
I know
meat.
You know her. Good meat. That's right. It was a bit, Deborah Krasner. Mm-hmm. I think that was like 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
That she was here on
such
Mouthful.
A good book.
It's
She's
a really
such
good book.
A good person.
And then 2 weeks from tonight, we will have Marisa Gugiana on, who has
Excellent.
Just come out with her fabulous book, Primal
right.
Cuts, with interviews. Really up-close interviews, photographs, recipes from, I think, 50 butchers around the country.
The butchers are becoming rock stars these days.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
It's the new celebrity in the food world. It's one of the best developments I can think of.
Yeah.
Because they need the attention to understand that link.
Right.
Is so important. And
right.
the book is, I just got a copy of the book in the mail. It's really a fabulous book. So that's Marisa Gugiana coming up in 2 days. And then how much are tickets for the Sonoma Country Day event?
I believe it's $10.
$10. You can get them at the door?
Yeah.
At the door. Okay.
It's going to be a really good event. I hope people will show up. And we're trying to get all different kinds of people represented, even someone who sells chicken tractors. And,
mm-hmm. and the book, again, is CAFO, Concentrated Animal Feeding Operation, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories. It is it $50? $40.
Yeah, it's $50.
Mm-hmm. 7 pounds of research, photographs and really, really good information. Now, is this book, will we find this in local bookstores throughout Sonoma County?
You know, I'm not sure. You should be able to get it wherever, you know, books are sold. There's okay. also a small reader version that doesn't have the pictures, and it only has the essays as well.
Oh, really?
And it's called the CAFO Reader.
And where do you get that?
You know, again, you can, your favorite bookseller
okay.
online, or, you know, ask your favorite bookstore to get it.
Now, when you finish this, we're going to end with this little story. I love this story. What did you do for yourself when you finished this book? I think it was really interesting.
Yeah. I spent January through May at the Berklee College of Music studying music. I really needed a psychological purge. After dealing with this heavy-duty animal factory stuff for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And I have a son who's going to school back in Massachusetts as well. So I really just dived into music at this fabulous university.
Any particular concentration of music?
You know, I had to audition and sign up as a freshman, but
what did you audition?
As a songwriter.
So, as a songwriter?
Yeah,
okay.
So I played guitar and sang a piece that I wrote, and it was really extremely nerve-wracking. But they let me in, and then I had to figure out how to do it, and it was tremendous. Yeah, Berklee has such a great approach to teaching, and there, you know, there's various moving parts of music that they expect you to master, and they all interconnect and work with each other, and they just throw you right in the fire, mm-hmm. and you know, you got to sink or swim.
Well, what a great thing to be able to do for yourself after writing such an important, I really commend you. This is a really important book. I hope a lot of people see it. Thanks very much for coming back to Mouthful, and I know we'll see you again.
Yeah, it's always fun to be here. Thanks a lot.
And I hope Thursday night is great. And I'm going to put up information about Thursday night on Mouthful's Facebook page. I will also be featuring it in my new blog on the Press Democrat website called Eat This Now. That will be up in the next day or two. So that's it. And on that note, time flies on Mouthful. So meet me back here next week for another episode of the Wine Country's most delicious and perhaps informative hour, Mouthful. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Have a great week.
Just say it.